Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
On Lingua Franca earlier this year, hello, I'm Maria Zylstra, the polyglot Alexandra Eichenwald dizzied us with her facility for a multitude of languages in her tale of how her life came to be steeped in them. What she's most interested in, though, is linguistic typology. That's studying how languages are structured and so how they work, as well as comparing them to ascertain recurrent patterns and variations. And here she is to tell something of that process of classification.
Languages can be classified into types based on numerous parameters. One concerns the order of the meaningful elements. In English, the verb has to follow the subject, as in I saw a dog. But in Fijian, the verb has to come first. So, English is verb medial and Fijian is verb initial, while Malambu from New Guinea is verb final. One can also classify languages depending on whether words neatly divide into parts with one meaning each. So, in isolating languages like Vietnamese, every form has one meaning. And in a fusional language like Latin, one little form can combine many meanings. For instance, I, the shortest form in Latin, has a complex meaning of you singular go imperative. Languages can also be classified depending on the number of meaningful parts within a word. Some languages are known as polysynthetic. In Nahuatl from Mexico, one word, Ninanagua, has a complex meaning of I eat meat, and there are many other possible parameters. Every category in a language warrants a typological classification. Here is a cross-linguistic study of two categories, one pretty common and one less so. There is no doubt that the grammar of a language influences the way people think and how they conceptualize reality. Grammar can influence our behavior and our beliefs and superstitions. Gender, found in many familiar European languages, is perhaps one of the most fascinating categories in this respect. When my Russian-speaking grandmother would drop a spoon or a fork, she would say, "Oh, we're expecting a female visitor." And if she dropped a knife, she would predict that a man would come. I wondered why it was so. I asked her, and she said, "Knife is masculine, and in Russian you refer to it as he, and both spoon and fork are feminine, and you refer to them as she." "But why?" I asked. She was not a linguist, and she could only say, "This is the way things are." But this isn't so for most other European languages. In Portuguese, spoon and knife are feminine, and fork is masculine. In German, spoon is masculine, he, fork is feminine, she, and knife is neuter, it. So, when I tell my German and Portuguese friends about this Russian superstition, they just shrug their shoulders. For those who speak Estonian, a language with no genders and just one word for he, she, and it, this custom makes even less sense. Language learners often complain that gender in European languages is useless and unpredictable. But this isn't altogether true. Gender choice in every language is based to some extent on the meaning of a noun. If a language has a masculine and a feminine gender, then men are usually talked about as he and woman as she. But gender choice may be made more complex in individual languages. For instance, in some, the form of a noun referring to an inanimate entity influences the gender choice. The reason why spoon, ложка, and fork, вилка, in Russian are feminine is because they end in a vowel, a, and knife, нож, is masculine because it ends in a consonant. And there are other aggravating circumstances. The reason why the word for girl, Mädchen, in German is neuter, it, is because it contains a suffix, hen. This suffix is called diminutive and appears in words used to refer to small things. So, the form of the word overrides the meaning. But the meanings of gender may be more elaborate. The indigenous Australian language Dirbal, spoken in North Queensland, as described by Professor Bob Dixon, one of the most prominent typologists, has four genders. One for masculine, which includes men, fishes, and animals. One for feminine, which covers women and also water, fire, and fighting, one for non-flesh foods and the remaining one, neuter, for all the rest. The way that gender is chosen is not 100% straightforward, but there are two principles. One is the myth and belief principle. In Dirbal, birds are classed as feminine by mythological association, since women's souls are believed to enter birds after death. The other one is the important property principle. Many words belonging to the feminine gender in Dirbal share one important property. They are dangerous, as are fire and fighting. And so, most trees without edible parts belong to neuter gender, but stinging trees are placed in feminine gender. Most fishes are considered masculine, but dangerous fishes are feminine. Men are typically masculine and women feminine, but a hermaphrodite in the community was referred to as she. A few languages in the remote Sipik area of New Guinea have two genders, masculine for men and feminine for women. I have done extensive work on one such language, Manambu, spoken by about 2,000 people in the Ambunti area on the Sipik River. For the Manambu, everything big and long is considered masculine, and everything short and round is considered feminine. A big house is masculine and a small one is feminine. In Avatip, the major village where Manambu is spoken, I remember endless discussions about whether Buckingham Palace is big enough to be considered masculine. Everyone agreed that Big Ben is masculine. Many of the Manambu people have studied overseas and know Great Britain quite well. Men are usually masculine and women feminine, but an unusually fat and big woman or the one behaving in a bossy way can be looked upon as masculine. A squat fetish man can be referred to as she. This is reminiscent of pejorative overtones of femininity in such English expressions as female logic or old wives' tale. He's a drama queen, said about a particularly fussy man. He's an old woman, said about a man who was basically useless. What this reflects is the traditionally low and subservient position of women in society. This also applies to many small languages spoken by no more than 200 people in far corners of the world. Referring to a woman with masculine gender as he implies promoting a woman to a higher status in Tariana, an Arawak language from northwest Amazonia, and in Jarawara, from southern Amazonia, calling a woman he is a mark of affection and respect. In English, too, the use of pronouns he and she correlates with stereotyped roles and images of men and women. Andy Pauly, emeritus professor from the ANU, discovered that, in Tasmanian English, using she for nouns referring to portable goods, but not vehicles, is a mark of affection or something one manipulates. For instance, a soccer ball has been kicked into a tree. A player, shaking the branch, says, "She's stuck! Come down, you bitch!" A typologist studies all the parameters of variation for a category, such as gender, mapping the principles of gender choice and their semantic extensions. This helps us describe and understand lesser-known languages, as well as to explain what we find in the more familiar languages, since seemingly peculiar gender choices in English are not so strange when looked at within the perspective of what we find elsewhere. But no two languages are entirely the same, nor are they entirely different. It is as if there was a universal inventory of possible grammatical and lexical categories, and each language makes a different set of choices from this inventory. Franz Boas, an American linguist and anthropologist, considered a founding father of modern linguistics, put it in this way. Languages differ not in what one can say, but in what kind of information must be stated, so that grammar determines those aspects of each experience that must be expressed. In a number of languages, every statement must contain some marker of the kind of evidence on which it is based, such as whether the speaker saw it, heard it, inferred it from indirect evidence, or learned about it from someone else. This grammatical category, indicating the information source, is called evidentiality. In Tariana, now only spoken by about 100 people on the Brazilian side of the border with Colombia, in the depths of Amazonian jungle, I would not be able to just say, Madonna fell downstairs. If I want to speak proper Tariana, I would have to add a little suffix at the end of the verb. If I actually see Madonna falling down a flight of stairs, I would say, Madonna fell ca down the stairs. Ca shows that I saw what happened. If I didn't see it, but heard the clatter of the fall and Madonna shrieking, I'd have to say, Madonna fell marca down the stairs. Marca shows that I heard what happened. If I walk to the bottom of the stairs and see that Madonna is lying all in a heap, this would be enough for me to infer that she had fallen down the stairs. I then say, Madonna fell nika down the stairs. Nika shows that what I say is inferred based on the results I saw. Finally, if someone else told me what had happened and I'm reporting this, I would have to use the reported suffix, Madonna fell pidaka down the stairs. Using your evidentials in the right way is important for successful communication. Quechua, the largest indigenous language in South America, has three evidentials, one for visual information, one for inference, and one for hearsay. The early missionaries, and many non-indigenous people nowadays, didn't know how to use evidentials, considering them ornate particles. As a result, Quechua speakers considered these white people somewhat stupid, or outright crazy, or even liars. Languages vary in how many evidential meanings can be expressed. The most common system is just having a means for expressing hearsay information, like an Estonian. Something like, Tema on arst, he is a doctor, and Tema olevat arst, he is hearsay a doctor. The form olevat has the meaning of is hearsay, and it has further meanings too. One of incredulity. It is said that he is a doctor, but I don't really believe it. Grammatical evidentiality, such as in Estonian or Tariana, is found in about a quarter of the world's languages. Based on a cross-linguistic typological study, for which I studied the grammars of about 500 languages, we can map the existing parameters for sources of evidence. For instance, no spoken language has a special marker for smell or taste. Both are usually subsumed with heard under non-visual evidential, just like the Tariana marca, but not so for sign languages. Catalan sign language is reported to have a special evidential indicating that something is known through the sense of smell, but has no evidential for information acquired through hearing, since the community is deaf. This opens up questions about the link between cognition and language. To be able to ask and to answer general questions about what human languages are like, which is what a typologist does, one needs to look at as many languages as possible, so as not to be biased. At present, there are perhaps over 4,000 languages spoken in the world. Many of them will probably not be spoken within 100 years. When a language sinks into oblivion, knowledge is lost about how things could be said or perceived and how a human mind can express itself through an intricate grammar. The less we know about small languages, the less insight we have about the languages we ourselves speak. The best way to go about it is to venture out into the field to be exposed to and to learn previously undescribed languages in out-of-the-way remote locations. I have worked on languages from North Africa, South America, and New Guinea, and am planning to work on more before it is too late. And this is an urgent priority for all of us before these fascinating languages get engulfed by their powerful and much less fascinating neighbors, such as English.
Professor Alexandra Eichenwald is the Academic Coordinator of the Research Centre for Linguistic Typology at La Trobe University near Melbourne. And I'm Maria Zylstra. Join me for Lingua Franca at the same time next week here on ABC Radio National.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.